Today's show is brought to you by Grammarly, an intelligent writing app that works as your own personal editor. Download Grammarly's browser extension and create a free account at getgrammarly.com/cinemarecall. This podcast may contain adult language, adult situations, spoilers, and some brief nudity, so parental guidance is adjusted.
We have such sights to show you.
After about 5 minutes of this movie, you're gonna wish you had 10 beers.
I'm such?
And?
And there are many gifts in the world and many Toms as well. But I am Sancho.
Human sacrifice, dogs and cats living together, mass hysteria.
Listen, Walter.
Listen, I made a great report out of you, Hildy, but you won't be half as good on any other paper, and you know it. We're a team. What we are, you need me, and I need you, and the paper needs
all of America.
So, what would you little maniacs like to do first?
Hi, I'm Chucky. Wanna play?
Oh, well. La-di-da, la-di-da, la-la, yeah.
Welcome back to the Cinema Recall Podcast. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the very last episode of our De Palma December month here at Cinema Recall. I'm your host, The Vern, and I guess you could say I've saved the best for last, but all of our guests in the past have been the best. But these two gentlemen are also very great as well. I have on with me Matt and Ashley of the podcast, Matchley at the Movies. Hello, gentlemen.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes. And for our listeners out there, since this is an audio podcast and they can't see your beautiful, handsome faces, can you tell me who's who here?
I am Matt.
I am Ashley.
Hello, folks. All right. Yes. So, Matt Ashley, the host of the wonderful podcast, Matchley at the Movies. You can find them on Twitter at Matchley Movies. And they do a stream of movie reviews. They just got done in October doing the 31 Days of Horror podcast. How did that go for you, gentlemen? How did you enjoy that?
That's a labor of love for me. That's sort of my baby. I loved it. I always love it doing every year. It's a bit exhausting because, you know, watching 31 horror movies with the intent to record our thoughts about them. It's just a little different than just watching them purely for fun. But yeah, I love it.
Yeah, it's a highlight for me too. I wasn't always a big horror movie fan, but Matt has introduced me to a lot of really good ones. And yeah, I always enjoy doing that now this year.
Was there any ones that surprised you? Or ones you'd never seen before? Or?
Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I avoided that movie because, well, the title says it all. It sounds a little too intense for me.
Oh, sure.
But it's a fantastic movie. Now, I won't be seeing it again anytime soon. but yeah, what a wonderfully made horror film.
Well, very cool. Now, you guys don't just cover horror films. You cover a whole spectrum of movies. I'll ask you, Matt. Tell me kind of like how Matchley at the Movies came to be. And tell listeners about more of your show. This is your chance to plug away and let them know all about it.
Sure. We started because we typically see a lot of movies. You know, pre-pandemic, you know, we would often go to the theater, usually at least once a week, every now and then, you know, more than that. So, like, people at work would ask me, like, for my take on movies that were out and new because, you know, I saw them pretty much before most regular people did. And I don't know, it got to a point where I'm like, you know what, we should just do a podcast. We should like just do something where people can go to and hear what our thoughts are about the movies. I mean, there's a little ego involved in it, right? But yeah, so that's kind of how it started. And we know as growing up as kids, we watched the Siskel and Ebert show, and there's like there's a YouTube movie review show that we watched pretty religiously. So that kind of inspired us. So yeah, that's how we started. We started, our first episode was January 1st, 2018. So we're coming up on 3 years.
Damn. 3 years. That is amazing stuff. And I love the best about your conversations because you two don't always agree on movies. And that's always kind of a fun thing to hear, but a lot of times you do. And yeah. I love the fact, too, that you're covering a lot of Criterion features. You can find a lot of their reviews and their podcasts through their website, matchleymovies.com. I think recently they have, for their Criterion, they just released an episode on a review of All the Heavens Allows. They did reviews of Mank, Sleep with Anger. Yeah, just whole slew. You reviewed recently the 2020 version of Rebecca. And just in one word, Ashley, how would you describe the 2020 version of Rebecca? One word.
Colorful.
Colorful. Okay. All right. Matt, same question. Rebecca, 2020. One word. No, no. I want you to do in three words.
Not as good.
Okay.
And then to continue on with that, as the Alfred Hitchcock version.
Right. Yes. Well, speaking about Hitchcock, that's kind of a good little segue in talking about the films of Brian De Palma. And I know this guy has been compared to a lot of like Hitchcock films, and even though he's been influenced by him, I don't know if I would call him a ripoff of Hitchcock. What do you think about that, Matt? Is he a ripoff of Hitchcock?
Well, no. My short answer is no. You know, in preparation for this podcast we're doing with you, we watched Sisters, and that certainly, I wouldn't call it a ripoff. That's certainly an homage to Hitchcock. There's absolutely no escaping that. However, I was also reviewing, you know, I looked on IMDb to look at his, you know, filmography for the movies he's directed, to see which ones, first of all, that I'd seen, which have been a few. But it's interesting, there are movies that I've seen that I did not, I guess, realize were Brian De Palma films. And I think he goes across a lot of genres. He's got a very kind of varied style or filmography, I guess, at least of subject matter. Mm-hmm. I think he does have an interesting style.
Sure.
But yeah, no. So I don't think you can pigeonhole him and say, oh, he's just a, you know, Hitchcock ripoff. I don't agree with that at all.
Well, I was listening to an interview that Quentin Tarantino had on the Masters of Horror, that podcast show that Eli Roth hosts, and he was talking about Brian De Palma features. And on the interview, he was saying that, yes, I'm pretty sure he saw, you know, Psycho and other movies and was influenced by that, but then I'm sure when Repulsion came out from Roman Polanski, he was like just really just more influenced by that as well. And I think that all directors probably take their influences from different directors. And with Sisters, I got much more of a Repulsion vibe and even a Rosemary's Baby vibe in a way from that movie more than anything from Psycho. It's like seeing those movies done through a different lens. Like, I'm pretty sure that De Palma was using certain techniques because he had some of this. He had the same composer, Bernard Herrmann, composed stuff for Sisters that did a lot of other Hitchcock stuff as well. But then seeing the story of Sisters reminded me a lot of Repulsion and other early Polanski films as well. Ashley, any comments there about De Palma and the influences he has from Hitchcock and Polanski and whatnot?
Nothing other than it, you know, it's pretty obvious with this movie, Sisters.
Sure.
You know, from the opening credits, right, with the Bernard Herrmann score, you know, I started kind of ticking off mentally all the different kind of homages to Hitchcock. They're strewn throughout the picture, I think.
Yeah, actually, we can talk later, but I have sort of some comments about my first viewing and then my most recent viewing of this movie and what I thought about. I thought about it in relation to Hitchcock, so we can talk about that later.
Well, let's kind of start off with that. We're gonna just take a small little break right now. I gotta play some ad spots from some amazing podcast shows, and then we'll be back to talk about Sisters.
After these messages, we'll be right back.
Life on a spaceship can be boring. That's what I hear. Though life aboard the Oz 9 is mostly about careening from one near disaster to the next. To fend off boredom, Gated Galaxies outfitted their ships with a number of challenges, like bombs, poisoned crew meals, and assassins. One nice thing they did, and we can only assume it was accidental, was to include the old-time Earth podcast, Grand Rapidians Play Video Games. Hosted by video game world record holders Willie, Ginger, and usually Simon, they review beers, describe video games, recommend other podcasts, and generally crack wise and have a grand old time. Not that we can enjoy any of the things they recommend, but whatever. Grand Rapidians Play Video Games, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
This podcast is a proud member of the LAMB Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.
You are about to witness history in the making.
Hi there, this is Todd from Forgotten Films, and if you spend all your time watching new releases, then you need to broaden your movie horizons. And a great way to do that is by joining me for the Forgotten Filmcast. We don't talk about the new releases, we don't even talk about the classics. We talk about the movies that time forgot. On each episode, I'm joined by another film blogger to discuss a film that may or may not be worth rediscovering. So look for the Forgotten Filmcast on iTunes, Podomatic, and wherever you find great podcasts.
For being a listener of Cinema Recall, Grammarly is offering a free download of their software. If you host a website or podcast, it's really important that your followers and subscribers understand everything that you want to communicate with them. With Grammarly, you can have your own personal editor who not only does spell checks, but makes sure the tone of the piece is what you want. Get your free download by visiting getgrammarly.com/cinemarecall. This podcast is a proud affiliate of the Let's Chat Podcast Network. Find out how you can become a part of this team by going to letschatpodcast.net and click on the Let's Chat Affiliates tab.
Conjoined twins called Siamese challenge life at their first breath. Some twins have been separated and lead normal lives. Others never can. Sisters, they were once one in body and perhaps one in mind. Danielle and Dominique, one loving, one hating, one innocent, the other... Where does Danielle end and Dominique begin?
Remember.
He's a freak! Freak. I had the freak! 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 Freak!
Sisters. Rated R.
And we're back. Thank you very much for checking out those ad spots. We're here to discuss Sisters, not the Tina Fey, Amy Poehler movie from 2015. No, we're going to talk about the 1973 movie starring Margot Kidder, Jennifer Salt, written and directed by Brian De Palma. Music by Bernard Herrmann. Yeah. So I'll start with you, Ashley, on this one. Was this your first time watching the movie, or have you seen it before?
We watched it last night, and that was our second viewing.
So I wasn't quite sure if you saw this movie separately before you watched it together, because it came out several years past. So so it was your second time watching it together.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. So I'll ask you both, and tell me about the first time you watched this movie. When was it?
I think when it came out on Criterion.
Maybe. I'm not sure when it did. So we have the DVD of Criterion. Right. I know it's been since released on Blu-ray.
Yeah.
But we have the DVD, which works fine. Yeah. And I don't know, at least a decade ago, if not longer.
Yeah, because I had forgotten a lot about it. So it was definitely good that we watched it again.
Do you remember, your responses was your first time watching it? Because I'll tell you about mine, but I just don't want to hear about yours.
Yeah, I mean, I remember really loving it. It has two actresses in it that I really love, Jennifer Salt and Margot Kidder, as you mentioned. I remember it being, suspenseful and disturbing, and I did remember the kind of Hitchcock homage that it obviously is. But beyond that, I couldn't really remember the actual plot details. So, I got a lot, I think, out of watching it again.
Right. Yeah, I certainly, was looking forward to watching it again, but I almost wondered if I needed to. It turns out I did, but there are elements of this movie that are seared into my brain. And Vern, did you say it was okay to talk about spoilers?
Yes, I should let people know this offhand here, and I will put a warning at the beginning of the show. But yes, there are going to be spoilers for Sisters. And I was trying to figure out the best way to kind of introduce this movie. And so I'm basically just going to read you the IMDb plot description of this. It's not the best, but it's the best one I can find that's not really spoiler-free. So it just says on here, a small-time reporter tries to convince the police that she saw a murder from the apartment across from hers, which I think is the best way to talk about this movie without getting into spoilers here, because this movie changes perspectives a lot in this. And that's what I kind of love about the movie, because you start with the perspective of one person, and then halfway through, there's perspective changes, and suddenly we are in another character's shoes, and then halfway through that, it changes perspective again, and then we're seeing the perspective of another character. And there's one key moment where that's displayed, but I'll talk about that later. But go ahead, Matt. I'm sorry. I was interrupting your story there.
No, the murder scene that's described there, that's the part that was the thing I remember the most. Now, when we rewatched it for this podcast, a lot of stuff after the murder was a little more fuzzy in my memory, and some of the things I just didn't remember at all. But yeah, that murder scene, it incorporates a split screen.
Yep.
And the musical score, I did remember the musical score for Bernard Herrmann from this movie, and then a murder scene in particular, it is both familiar Bernard Herrmann and also unlike anything I've ever heard from him before.
Yeah, a lot of like synth work in there.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So, and then, yeah, you're right, it does change perspectives even in the murder scene with the split screen, and you see a view from inside Margot Kidder's apartment, and then you see a view from Jennifer Salt's apartment. That I was really wowed by that, and I was also a little distracted because I was trying to figure out how do they do that technically, because they do the split screen multiple times throughout the film, and I'm like, so is this truly just a two camera setup where they have, you know, one camera on one side and another one on the other, or is this actually done in multiple takes and this is made to look like it's seamless? So, I don't know, it's very fascinating from a technical standpoint.
And I think that scene kind of best shows the split of minds, because Sisters is essentially about conjoined twins that were separated. Yes, sorry, spoiler alert there, folks. but I thought that way that split screen was used in that moment was to show the splitting of the minds between the two sisters. Not you know, physically right away, but kind of literally that way, yeah. No, but let's kind of one thing I kind of do want to start with here before we get to the story of the murder sequence is how things came to be before the murder sequence happens, because I thought it was actually great, and I don't really want to do like a plot by plot description, but the way the movie opens is absolutely brilliant. I love the title sequence. It's got this like you think you're going into this horror film with the score, those opening titles right there. You are in the mood for something suspenseful and tense. And then you go right away into this TV show called Peepers. This punch-like TV show. And so just the differences between the opening titles and that game show. I guess it is a game show. More like a punt show. I'm not quite sure how to describe Peepers, but
it's based on, I think I read somewhere, and it's based on Candid Camera. So.
Oh, okay. But very much more like a raunchier Candid Camera, because apparently, I guess, girls get naked, and I guess this guy is trying not to look, and if he doesn't look, he gets points or something.
Yeah, well, it's interesting you mentioned the kind of contrast between the opening credits and then the opening scene, because, you know, you're right about the opening credits and the score and whatnot. And then we kind of get punked again, because when the movie opens, the movie actually opens on a close-up of Lyle Wilson's crotch through his boxers, I guess, and he's zipping up his pants, and he's in a locker room. And then Margot Kidder comes in looking like she's blind and starts undressing. And so you think this is just, you know, a scene in the movie, right? And then it turns out, no, this is actually a clip that they're showing on a game show.
Yeah.
It's a scene within a scene.
It's like very much like a misdirect. And I kind of feel like this is sort of like Brian De Palma just going, hey, look, folks, I'm going to totally misdirect you in this movie. All right. Here's a little preview. Here's a little hint that I'm going to totally just kind of fool around with you. And what you think you're expecting, you're not really going to expect there. Now, I didn't really...
Also, I'll say this, too. It's also the first clue we get that this is a fairly sexual movie. And you see that from this opening scene where people are undressing or putting on their clothes, and that is voyeuristic. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a theme of sexuality and voyeurism that runs throughout this movie. And this opening scene, I think this kind of kicks things off with that.
Very much
And then on the second viewing of this movie, too, I picked up on there's another subtext, I think a misogynistic subtext.
Sure.
That this game show gets right at, right?
Mm-hmm.
She's already being exploited.
Mm-hmm.
There's that voyeuristic element. So yeah, it catches you off guard after the title sequence. But yeah, it gets right to the themes of the movie. So
this is where you kind of like first meet Margot Kidder's character of Danielle Britton. So the guy that was at the contest, I don't remember his name.
Lyle Wilson.
What's that?
Yeah.
Oh, say that again?
Lyle Wilson. He plays Philip Wood.
Oh, Lyle Wilson. Okay. Thank you. Okay. So Lyle Wilson and Margot Kidder's character, they end up going on a date. They end up going into this restaurant, which I'm sure at the time was fine, but I don't know today would work so well. Maybe it will. I don't know for sure. I mean, an African restaurant that actually serves, you know, African cuisine wouldn't be too bad if they, you know, put the right clientele in there. I'm not sure. And then they actually do end up going home together. And the morning when he wakes up, finds out that I forgot when he finds out that it's a birthday, but he ends up getting a cake. I don't quite remember how he got the cake, because I did watch this recently, but it's been like a week since I last watched it. And
well, he has to go out to Margot Kidder is on, she's taking medicine. Mm-hmm. She needs more, and so she needs more, and he goes out to get her some, I think, from the pharmacy, and then he sees a bakery.
Yes. Okay.
Where he goes, he decides, hey, you know, I just found out it's her birthday and her sister's birthday.
Yeah.
Because she mentions her sister Dominique.
Yeah.
And so he decides to, you know, go in and get a cake. With a message on there to both of them. And we have a lovely cameo, an uncredited cameo from the great Olympia Dukakis, who is she plays somebody who works at the bakery. So, yeah.
Oh, okay. Oh, very cool. Yeah. Now, the moment when he does bring the cake inside, and I gotta admire this guy's balancing skills to balance a cake with the candles all lit, and he brings it in, puts it right to her. She grabs the knife slowly, because it looks like she's like slowly waking up, and you don't even like, when I watched it, I did watch like certain scenes of the second time, and the way she grabs that knife is just so gradual that you didn't even notice it's happening until he says, hey, what are you doing? You know, I thought I was going to cut the cake, and then bam, stabs him right away. The score comes on. I'm still always kind of shocked by that moment. Now, I do know I did watch some documentaries of this film, and the fact that Margot Kidder herself was going slowly and slowly more insane as they shot this film, which doesn't surprise me. I mean, Margot Kidder has had a really tough life, and bad things happen with her. I'm not going to go into too much details about that, but the look in her eyes was just... it just insanely looking right there. I mean, rewatching it again, what did you think about her performance in that scene?
It was good. I remember that scene. It was different watching it after the first time, because the first time, you know something's not right, but you're not quite sure what's going to happen, and you know something is. But it was still unsettling. So one thing I want to talk about with this movie and the directing and the editing and whatnot for this film, but you know, when he brings the cake back to her apartment, there's a scene where he gets it out of the box in the kitchen, and he's taking it out and he's putting candles on it and he's lighting the candles. And it's interesting that, you know, in certain movies, that scene would be ponderous and unnecessary. You don't necessarily need to see him do all of that to get the point across. Mm-hmm. But it works here because De Palma is creating this undercurrent of suspense and dread. Because, you know, while the Philip character is out getting the cake, you know, we see Margot Kidder's character back at her apartment kind of going crazy, mm-hmm. In her bathroom, and it's not, you know, something's not going well with her. And then when he comes back in, she's just kind of laid out on the bed, not looking well. He seems a little oblivious about it. But so the fact that we know something's not right, and of course, Bernard Herrmann scores in the background helping, but, you know, it makes that moment he has with the cake, it makes it work because, like I said, there's this undercurrent of dread. And then, yes, it is still shocking when she starts attacking him. And it's the blood in this movie is very interesting. It's very bright.
Yeah.
It almost looks fake.
Yeah.
But it works because it's just, this movie's almost nightmarish in its quality. It's like we're watching one big long nightmare. So you kind of accept, you know, the non-ordinary nature of the how the blood looks and everything.
Yeah.
The blood kind of remind me how the blood looked in Suspiria.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's all heightened.
Very heightened reality there too, and even some of the blood used in Kill Bill Volume 1. Yeah. Well, let's kind of get into some of the characters in this movie, some of the actors and characters in the movie. I'm going to kind of start off with Margot Kidder. Very, very kind of a small role. She's not in the movie. Well, she's in the movie throughout of it, but her role just kind of like cut down. At first, I thought she was just this actor who was going on a date with this person. I know that she had a sister, and then she goes, kills a guy. Wasn't quite sure why. Later on, we did some things revealed about her, but I really thought that she had some of the most intense performances. Now, keep in mind that when I first saw this movie, the only thing I ever knew Margot Kidder from was Lois Lane in Superman. That's the only thing, that's only like frame of reference. So, at the time, I have not seen her just try to play this role. And then when I watched it the second time, I kind of knew more about her past and everything that happened with her. And I was like, oh, okay. All right, you know. So we watched it again, knowing that aspects of her mind, that for me made it a much more different watch. And I thought her performance was intense. It was very scary, just knowing what happens to her later on. But yeah, I just thought she was really good in this one too. I don't know if you guys had any thoughts about her performance in this.
Yeah, so I'm a big fan of Margot Kidder. I think she was a really talented actress, and particularly the films that she made in the 70s. There's just a vulnerability to her, and you know, you're right. She did have a rough go of it, and she suffered from mental illness from a young age. And I don't know how much of that informs her performances, but I think it has to. There's just a fragility to her and something a little unstable about her that I've always kind of found intriguing. And, you know, it's just a year after this that she made, she starred in Black Christmas.
Yes, yes, that's right. Also very much a different performance in that one, too. That one she kind of plays, you know, the drunk comic relief in a way. But she always gets into performances, like, really hardcore. Because I know, like, on the making of Black Christmas, she was actually really drunk during the role there. And when she got into her performance of Sisters, like, the moment that Matt talked about before, where she's in her apartment kind of going crazy, she actually started to get really, like, into her role. Like, these things were happening to her for real, and there are moments on set where she would, like, break down and cry. And I know that both Margot Kidder and Jennifer Salt, they each shared an apartment before this movie was made, and they used to have a bunch of, like, filmmakers and actors show up at their place. This is where they would be introduced to Brian De Palma, and Brian De Palma and Margot Kidder would start dating, and then the three decided to come up with a movie where they would star in together. And I know this movie had a lot of problems trying to get made. I think at 1.2, De Palma and his producers asked a toy store to help put up the money for it, and they did. I think getting the most money for this movie had to be for Bernard Herrmann's score. Let's talk a little bit about Jennifer Salt's character as the reporter, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
Are there thoughts there about Margot Kidder that I missed out on, or?
No, I think Ashley, I agree with pretty much what Ashley said. And okay. He's more of a fan of hers than I am, but I respect her work. You know, it's interesting. I rewatching this again, I was picking up on a lot of, you know, the, I guess you'd call them Hitchcock elements. And I was reminded of Psycho, particularly in a couple of ways, aside, obviously, from the Bernard Herrmann score.
Sure.
But, you know, this, the murder scene, for one thing, the murder when Lyle Wilson's character gets killed, I mean, that to me is kind of up there with the shower scene in Psycho. I mean, as far as like just like I said, being kind of seared into your brain. I mean, it's just particularly, you know, it's particularly frenzied, you know, no pun intended. But no, there's a couple scenes. So and I'll get to Jennifer. I'm going to lead this into Jennifer Salt's character.
Okay.
But the first thing I thought about in relation to Psycho is there's a scene in the morning after. Margot Kidder and Lyle Wilson's characters have made love and have slept together. She wakes up and she goes into this back room and has this conversation with her sister Dominique, which reminded me a lot of when, you know, in Psycho, Norman Bates he's greeted Janet Leigh at the hotel and they talk in the back room. And then he goes up to the house and he talks with Mother.
Mm-hmm.
Those scenes reminded me quite a bit of each other.
Mm-hmm.
And then... So I do think Margot Kidder is a constant throughout this movie. However, the presence of her character does dip.
Yes.
After the murder scene and Jennifer Salt's character is introduced. And that then reminded me of, in a way, of the Vera Miles character mm-hmm. in Psycho, who we've never seen in the movie until, you know, Janet Leigh's character is killed off. And then all of a sudden, boom, here's Vera Miles and then John Gavin's back. Now in this movie, Margot Kidder, she's not obviously killed, but she does kind of dip it a little bit in her presence in the film. And then now we are introduced to Jennifer Salt, who's witnessed the murder. And she, you know, not unlike the Vera Miles character in Psycho, she ends up hiring a private detective played by Charles Durning, who's always good.
Yes, Don Copper from a Muppet movie. Here.
Yeah, he's good. But so, yeah, I think Jennifer Salt is... she's good in this. She's very solid. Ashley's a little more familiar with her because I'll let him explain why. But yeah, I thought she's really good in this.
Yeah, and mm-hmm. I love the way, too, that we mentioned before earlier how the perspective changes in that split screen sequence because you're seeing the perspective of Lyle Wood's character kind of like looking out the window and the camera seems to be like, you know, pulling out away and then. On the other screen, Jennifer Saltz, you're seeing the camera kind of pull into her, and she's seeing the actual murder, and we're kind of seeing things through her eyes. At first, we're seeing things through Lyle's eyes, because the dude's being murdered, about to die, reaching out for the window, looking out for someone to notice him, anybody, and he's seeing someone from across the window. We see a face there, but we're not quite sure who it is. And then the other screen, we're seeing it's Jennifer Saltz's character, and she's seeing the murder, and she goes to get help right away. Yeah, I'll ask you, Ashley, about Jennifer Salt's performance in this. And
sure. I think this is the only film that I've seen Jennifer Salt in. Sure, I was surprised to see that she was actually in two prior De Palma films, The Wedding Party and Hi, Mom. I'm not familiar with those movies, but she was kind of a regular De Palma actor at this point. But I know her from several years later. She was in the sitcom Soap for four seasons. That show ran from 77 to 81, and she played Eunice Tate, who, you know, that show was full of a lot of kind of goofy, kooky characters. She's a more straight-laced character, but it is a comedy, and she was funny. So I've never seen her in a serious role before. So yeah, I think she's solid. I think she's very believable as this journalist. You know, you're on her side immediately. You're wanting her to succeed. You're wanting her to you know, convince the cops that there really was a murder. And so I think she does a really good job here.
No.
And I thought, you know, she hasn't done a lot of acting. I think she's kind of retired from acting. But I was surprised, you know, looking at her IMDb, she's actually the executive producer of American Horror Story.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah, so very much still involved in the industry.
Yeah, so. No, that's great. I liked her role very much in this. I thought that her way she investigates and she gets the private detective, which of course is played by Charles Durning, to help out. There's Also, another actor in this that I forgot to mention at the start of the show, and he also plays kind of a big part in this besides Margot Kidder and Jennifer Saltz, and that is, I believe, William Finley, who plays Emil Breton. He plays the sort of like, at first you're not quite sure what his relationship is, because he is there to help Margot Kidder's character clean up the mess and clean up the body and sort of make sure that Jennifer Saltz's character doesn't investigate more into this, though, because I think he tells her, or at least Jennifer Saltz's character, that he's Margot Kidder's doctor, if I remember right. I think I may be off on that one. I'm not...
Well, he's introduced in a few different ways. I think one of them, at one point, he's introduced as her ex-husband or something.
That's okay.
Yeah. And it's a little, I'll be honest with you, having watched the movie again, and I'll be honest with you too, I'm not as up on the back half of this movie as I am the first
yeah,
half.
Same here.
And the back half starts involving dream sequences and whatnot, and I'm a little unclear about, I mean, the sexual themes continue very prominently in the dream sequences, and include his character like making out with Margot Kidder, but in a room that's in front of people watching. And I don't know what exactly is going on there, but it was creepy.
Yeah.
And yeah, I don't know what his actual relation to her was.
Yeah, here's the thing, too, folks. Like, when I'm watching the movie, after the murders happen and Jennifer Saltz's character is introduced, then we're into the investigation part of the movie. This is where he starts hiring a detective. There is a moment that happens when the police come to, I guess, investigate the murders, and it's kind of a split screen sequence where they're trying to clean up the mess as well, and they're interviewing Jennifer Saltz's character about what she thinks she saw, and they're trying to clean up the mess before the cops go to find the room cleaned up. This is the moment too where I guess they stuck the body in the couch cushions. And I know that the producer of this movie told De Palma, like, hey, look, that will never work. You'll never get a body in there. And DePaul says, no, I shot this all in one take so that we can actually put a body into the cushion of the couch there. And so that worked out. But after she does her investigation and she finds out about this hospital, that's where things get kind of lost for me. Everything becomes really surreal and out there and crazy. And it's really hard for me to describe this without you actually... see in the movie. And this is where a lot of the spoilers happen into the movie. I just like the fact knowing that it's a psychological thriller where you don't really quite know how it's going to end. And even though I've seen it twice, I just watched it last week or so, I still forgot a lot of it. And I think that's the power of the movie, that I can rewatch it and I'll still seem shocked every time. We talked about that moment when Lyle's character gets killed. When I rewatched it the second time this first week, I totally forgot that's how he got killed. I know he dies, but I just totally forgot how he dies, you know? And so the movie just kind of like really messes with your perceptions of how things are going to be. And even when we get to Jennifer Saltz's character and her investigation with the movie, in fact, even the guy she hires is not who he seems to be at the end of the movie. He's not, you know, the person that he says he's supposed to be in this.
I think he is.
He is. Okay. Okay.
He's just a dogged private investigator. I mean, really, he's like a dog with a bone. He's actually kind of sweet, the Charles Durning character, the private eye. He's very, you know, he's kind of the, you know, schlub of a private eye, and he just seems very sincere, and he follows his lead up until like the very end of the movie. At the very end of the movie, it's he's still following his lead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know we kind of talked briefly about Hitchcock's influence in this movie too. But rewatching this time, I really got the strong repulsion vibe that Roman Polanski made about a woman that slowly is go insane. In fact, a lot of the moments that happen in Repulsion happen in Sister Tegfall. See Repulsion?
We have not. I don't know.
Okay. Yeah, because there's like a lot of moments in that. Oh, well, that's totally bless you theme right there. Sorry, folks. I'm just trying to get my notes in order here because I just really want best to describe this movie without ruining it out there for audiences there. And that's going to be hard to do on the show. And I apologize immensely. But when Jennifer Salt is doing her in investigations on trying to get the police to believe her, I find it kind of odd that no one seems to believe her that much. The only one that it really kind of does is Charles Dern's character. And I don't even quite remember how they discovered about the hospital that Margot Kidder was staying in. Do you remember?
Jennifer Salt follows Margot Kidder and William Finley from the apartment.
Oh, yeah, she follows them. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Yeah.
Well, and it's interesting, too. You mentioned how the police don't really believe her. I found it interesting that she doesn't have a very good relationship with the police.
Sure.
Because she's a journalist who has been doing some stories about police brutality. That's something that I had forgotten. And, mm-hmm. you know, apparently this has been an issue for a long time.
Yes. That was a little bit of an awkward part. So when they're doing the split screen, this is just immediately after the murder. You see on the left-hand side is Jennifer Salt in her apartment, and she's calling the police because she's trying to report the murder. And it kind of awkwardly all of a sudden frames on articles she's written.
Yeah.
And the headlines where it's talking about, you know, police brutality or police cover-up or blah, blah, blah. It's very negative police things. And in those moments, I will say I like you, Ashley, I'd forgotten about that angle, but I was like, why are we focusing on that? What has this got to do, you know, with anything? And then it pieced together like, oh, okay, she's a journalist who has written exposés that are anti-police, so she's got this negative view of them.
Right. So automatically, when they arrive, they don't like her and they don't really want to believe her. So. I think that's an interesting little plot detail.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But so, well, you know, one thing that too that this movie has a lot of is, you know, visual style, the use of camera moments in this as well. But also we should talk about the notion of conjoined twins, because this movie is basically about conjoined twins who just got separated. And I remember in an interview with Brian De Palma, he says that he saw this article about these two conjoined twins, and one of them, they're just approaching adolescence, and one of them looked all bright and happy, but the other one kind of looked kind of like dour and sad, and just kind of like a little darkness of this. And so I want to ask you, folks, I mean, do you think this movie is kind of look at the bright and dark side of our own personas? I mean, the movie sisters, both Dominique and Danielle, I mean, they are twins, but do you believe that there's like kind of a dark side and a light side to all of us, and this movie just kind of like has a visual representation of both that?
There's a scene in the movie where I forget who's talking about it, but maybe it's the scene where Bernard Hughes, Jennifer Salt's character goes and talks to, I think it's a newspaper office, and the editor, whoever, is played by Bernard Hughes, and he sits her down and shows her, because his newspaper had done a story on these conjoined twins a year earlier. And so he shows her, like, some footage and whatever. It's a big plot dump, plot exposition. and I think it's him, I could be wrong, talks to her about how... there's Danielle and Dominique was the darker of the two.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very morose, very had issues. And Danielle was more sweetness and light. But he made a point of saying that he thinks the only reason Danielle was that way was because of Dominique. And though I found that interesting. There's a lot of pop psychobabble in this movie.
Yeah.
And it made me wonder, so on a surface level, because I think your question is interesting, but on a surface level, I did feel a little uncomfortable with how it presents conjoined twins, and not just these two, but I mean, conjoined twins throughout history, because it has a little, you know, historical review, and they're just presented as these poor, almost freakish creatures that are unstable. Mm-hmm. And I'm actually wanting to do some more research now, because I'm like, I don't know if that's accurate, or that's just something that they feel like it works for this movie. Now, as far as your question about, is this some sort of like under, you know, is this an analogy for our own, you know, light and dark halves of ourselves and our personalities? I mean, sure, maybe, possible.
Mm-hmm. I'm stretching there with the question that I know that.
Yeah, I think so. I think that the twins were separated, and I feel like there's a deep psychological impact to that that I don't think anyone had planned for. And I think, you know, Danielle is exhibiting, you know, the outcome of that surgery in a way that's very disturbing.
Yeah. I also kind of like Fat too, when William Finley's character is talking to Trevor Salt and he does that sort of hypnosis on her. I had the feeling too that Jennifer Salt's character was the other sister, the Dominique sister, the Dominique to Danielle, who didn't know she had a sister. I really kind of thought that, oh wow, she's the actual, is the conjoined twin, and they must have like separated her from birth and did something to her to make her not remember who she is, and she's doing this dream hypnosis to maybe awaken that who she is. But I do think that the William Finley character, who also plays the Phantom in Phantom of the Paradise, one of our previous episodes with the host from Shots in the Plot, be sure to check that out. But when he starts using hypnosis on her to get her to think that she is, because he uses hypnosis on her to like not to stop investigating the murder, saying that there was no murder and everything. But I really thought at a moment there that Jennifer Salt's character was the other sister. Did you think that at any point in the movie, or am I the only one that thought that?
Well, I felt like, so yeah, you're describing the part of the movie that gets pretty surreal.
Yes, I know. It's just hard to,
to kind of discern what's actually happening. There was a part of me watching it this time. I thought that he was trying to kind of embed into her consciousness this idea that she was the sister. And, you know, and there are scenes that you see in her dreams where she kind of looks to be the sister now. And I don't know if he's trying to replace Dominique so that Danielle will be better, because it seems like, you know, obviously a big part of her psychosis is missing her sister. So I kind of felt like that was his motivation. But then, you know, in the end, it wasn't successful if that was his motivation. So I'm not sure exactly what was going on there. But it makes for some very interesting and disturbing scenes.
Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah, the moment, because they actually did get a lot of people with physical, you know, I don't want to say deformities, but physical changes, their bodies right there, actual real people that were hired at freak shows to be in this movie. There actually was a guy that really had half his face missing, and there was there's three triplets who were kind of a pain on set as well. Yeah, I just found that whole notion, because really I'm like, oh, she probably could have been the actual sister, and they didn't tell her about it at all. And this is where the movie really starts to become confusing for me, and the fact is, the only shot I remember of this movie is of Charles Durning at atop a telephone pole looking at this box, which is, I'm assuming, of where the murder victim was that Margot Kidder's character stabs. I do remember that shot the most. I remember the very opening sequences after Marketer kills the character, but it's that whole kind of middle sequence right there. And you mentioned that this is a dream, and it feels kind of like a dream too, because you recall it, but you can't really describe it to people. I don't know, Matt. Maybe you can help me out here in trying to explain a little bit more about that dream sequence. And then at the end, I believe that Jeffrey Stoltz's character escapes, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, she does. I can't help you. If there's a part of the movie that I maybe dislike, it's actually the dream sequence. And I don't, you know, I know between the two of us, Ashley's a little more open to the whole surreal nature of certain movies. But I don't know, man. I mean, like, this movie follows a certain grounded reality for a while. I mean, it is heightened. I mean, like, you know, the style of this production is really cool, and I like it. We talked about the split screens and the score and the whatever, but it all is still relatively grounded in reality. Mm-hmm. And then you introduce this weird dream sequence, which I don't know. I feel like the back half of this movie has certain parts that are trying to be weird almost for the sake of being weird, and it's not, I don't know. It clashes with the rest of the feel of the movie, or at least the first half. And if this were like a David Lynch movie, which is just weird from start to finish, I may be more open to that dream sequence.
Sure.
But the fact that it exists in this movie is where I have an issue with. So I can't describe that. But yeah, Jennifer Salt does escape. I will say, too, a couple of just random thoughts. Jennifer Salt's character has a fate that befalls her at one point, which is a fear that I don't know why. It's a irrational fear that I have, and maybe I just do, which is you go to a mental hospital and you accidentally get admitted.
Yeah.
That's a weird thing I have. Another random thing, I want to give a quick shout out to Dolph Sweet, who plays Detective Kelly. He's one of the police that comes to investigate the murder after Jennifer Salt calls the police. I remember him from a kid growing up. He was a chief on Give Me a Break, the sitcom with Del Carter.
Oh, yeah, of course.
So he's good at playing policemen. And I do want to reference real quick back to something I mentioned earlier, that I had a sort of a different take on this viewing it from the first time I saw it and now this most recent time. And real quick, what I say about that is my takeaway from the first time I watched it was, wow, this is like a Hitchcock movie that's not made by Hitchcock. And my second time I watched it in preparation for this, I thought to myself, this is weird, because I was struck by the incongruous nature of the Bernard Herrmann score with a movie that didn't really seem like a Hitchcock movie. So the visuals of this seemed just very much, it seemed much more modern and gritty than a normal Hitchcock movie. Mm-hmm. But it had the familiar Bernard Herrmann score that we associate with so many Hitchcock films.
Yeah.
So I sort of had this weird disassociation for a little while. And then I just kind of slid into it and got used to it. But yeah. Those are some random thoughts I had.
No, I love that. I love that. And I do agree with you, too, that, yes, for it does kind of feel like a Hitchcock movie with the De Palma score and even some of the framing choices that were used. I know we did to the split screen. That's more of a Brian De Palma stage right there. But I mentioned earlier, though, when we watched it the second time, I got much more of Repulsion vibe. And if you folks ever get a chance to watch that movie, I would recommend it, just because Catherine Deneuve actually plays a similar role that Margot Kidder plays in this movie. If you haven't seen Repulsion is about a woman who's left alone in her apartment after her sister goes away for a week. Now, Catherine Deneuve is a very sexually repressed person. She keeps getting hit on by a bunch of men. And when she's left alone in this apartment, she believes that a lot of men are coming into her home to rape her and destroy her. And there actually are a few men that are doing that, but some aren't yet. There are moments that happen in Sisters, especially near the end when Jennifer Salt's character goes to the hospital. A lot of surreal sequences that happen in Sisters happens in Repulsion. So I think that, like I said before, the director was very much influenced by those two different directors and those styles and want to put a movie together. Now I know that right after this movie, De Palma would make Phantom of the Paradise, which is a very tongue-in-cheek horror musical comedy, very much a different form. I do love the fact, too, that even though De Palma is influenced by Hitchcock, and we mentioned before earlier, he has done a slew of other different movies. He doesn't stay in just one particular genre. I know he's best known for, like, Carrie and The Untouchables, but he has done just a whole slew of different movies. And
Can I use this moment then real quick to shout out that I am maybe the only fan in the world. A fan maybe is too strong, but I feel like I'm the only person in the world who likes Brian De Palma's movie from 2000 called Mission to Mars.
I have not seen that one. I heard a few people talk about that on the show, and I will check that out. I hoping I can maybe rent it, because I've noticed I watched a few of De Palma films on Stars, and I'm not doing that anymore just because they don't show the movies in the right aspect ratio when you watch movies on certain premium channel streaming sites. So I'm doing my best just to spend the $4 or $5 and just rent the movie, because I'm going to get the film the way that it was going to be. So if I find Mission to Mars on there, I will check it out. Yes.
Again, though, it's not very well thought of by most people, but I enjoyed it. I saw it at the theater and I thought it was fine.
All right. Very, very cool indeed. Well, any other kind of thoughts here about Sisters that we didn't really go over yet?
No, I think I've said a lot of what I think of it. I mean, I think it's a really striking film. It's mesmerizing in certain areas. It's an interesting artifact too of its time. I mean, you've got the Staten Island neighborhoods. You've got the scenes with, I love the establishing shots of, you see like the Staten Island ferry with Manhattan in the background. This film was filmed in early 1972. So you see the World Trade Center under construction in the background. And so I like the look and feel of it. I like the establishing shots. I like the score. I like the De Palma split screen, you know, stuff he's got going on there. The performances are you got two strong female performances in the two main leads here. It's got a lot going for it. It's also some weird voyeuristic, sexual, some slightly misogynist undertones to it that are kind of odd, I find, but you know, no, I like it. I think it's a great movie.
Go ahead, Ashley. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'll just say, I mentioned before, you know, seeing it a second time, I picked up on this misogynistic subtext, and I'm not sure completely what I mean by that, but I find it interesting and rather sad that by the end of this movie, both of our principal actresses, these characters, they have been abused in a way and psychologically manipulated in a way that is very harmful to them. Sure. And, you know, Jennifer Salt, her motivation and her desire was to do this wonderful article about this murder. And now she doesn't believe there is a murder.
Yeah.
I found that to be very powerful, and it's something I didn't really pick up on before.
That you have a good point right there too. Yeah, she totally, she's been influenced and brainwashed by the male counterparts to not even prove there was a murder anymore. That's why I kind of like the ending with Charles Durnan kind of being there. He's the one that kind of still believes there is a murder, and I'm pretty sure that he's gonna maybe help convince Jennifer Salt's character. So it does have it does end on a sad note, but there's just like this little glimmer of hope,
right? Yeah,
that maybe things can turn around. Now, when I was doing kind of research on this movie, I did not realize that this movie has a remake.
Oh, I didn't either.
So there was a remake that came out in 2006 that stars Chloe Sevigny as the Margot Kidder character, but they call her Angelique Annabelle. Chloe Sevigny, she plays the reporter that Jeff Salt plays. And then this actor, Lou Dalton, plays Angelique Annabelle. But yeah, it's a remake that came out in 2006. I remember vaguely seeing boxes of this movie because I used to work at a video store. And when I saw the Boss of Sisters, I looked up on IMDb and saw there was another version of Sisters. Like, well, I should watch this version first. But I never got to see the 2006 version. And I can't find this movie anywhere. It's not playing online anywhere. If I have to find it, I'll have to buy the DVD on eBay, because this movie just kind of went into obscurity. The critics all gave it a really low score. It was so low that it was supposed to have a theatrical release, but it never did. I'm vaguely curious about the movie just because of Chloe Sevigny, because I do like her as an actor, but I'm just not entirely sure. I'm always fascinated by remakes, even though I hate them. I'm always slightly fascinated by this. And being the fact this came out a few years later, I may check this out one of these times here, but not anytime soon. Definitely not for our diploma, December. Before we kind of like get, you know, wrapped up here on our diploma December, I'll ask you, Ashley, name your three top diploma films.
Oh my gosh, I need to see a list.
Oh. Okay.
Dress to Kill.
Okay.
This one, Sisters.
Okay.
Aren't you a fan of Blowout too?
Oh yeah, I do love Blowout. Yeah, so those are my three.
All right, Matt, what about you? What's your top three De Palma films?
Well, I think my favorite is probably The Untouchables. And then after that would be Mission Impossible. And, you know, I realized at the time that that was lambasted by the folks who had made the Mission Impossible series. In fact, I think Greg Morris like walked out of the screening of that. He'd been an actor in the original television series, and like they just thought it was awful. And I won't get into why, but I liked it, and it kicked off a really solid spy movie action franchise. And then I guess my third actually would be Sisters.
Nice.
Yeah.
Very cool. As for me, let's see now. This is a tough one. I gotta go more for Blowout, for sure. I gotta put Carrie on there, and the new recut version of Raising Kane. Raising Kane is a movie that I liked John Lithgow's performance in that one, but it wasn't too keen on the story. But once I saw the new director's cut recut version of Raising Kane, that just raised it up higher. So yeah, those, and that's my top three for right now. I probably put like even like Phantom of the Paradise, and maybe Snake Eyes, and Mission Impossible on another list as well. So I've got two of the movies right there. I'm gonna be rewatching the De Palma documentary that came out from A24, just to get a little more insights into his other movies, and I like the interviews he had on that program as well. I didn't get your scores for Sisters, and I apologize about that. Matt, out of 5 stars, what would you give Sisters?
4.
4. And Ashley, what about you?
I think I'd go 4.5.
4.5. Okay. I'm going to give Sisters out of 5. I'm going to just give it a solid... I'll give it about a 4 as well. I mean, the late downside of the movie I see is the kind of moment in the hospital, the whole dreamlight sequence there. It's fine, but if it was done in another director's hand, it would have been a lot better. So I'm going to give about a 4 as well, so I think our scores total up to about be like a total 5. So, strong score here for Sisters. Yeah, that's going to kind of wrap up our discussion about Sisters. I do want to give a big shout out and thank you to Matt and Ashley. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for helping me out on this episode. Hope you guys had fun talking about the movie Sisters.
We did. It was enjoyable to talk about it with you, and thank you for having us on the program.
Yes, thank you so much.
Thank you. Now, tell the listeners out there what's going to be happening for Matchy at the Movies in the new year here. We got a brand new year, a brand new president. All new things that are going to happen here. It's going to be just, I'm very excited and, you know, enthusiastic that hopefully we're going to get vaccines here soon and everything's going to be just fine. Anything new happened in the horizon for you gentlemen?
we're just going to continue reviewing, you know, new movies. And, you know, we're still watching them on streaming now. But, you know, yeah, we'll continue reviewing new films. We're going to continue our Criterion series where we talk about a movie available in the Criterion Collection. And we're starting a new segment in the new year. I'm not sure when yet, but it's called Bad Movie Night.
I love that. That's my wheelhouse right there.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm so excited.
Guests on, hopefully, for that. And, you know, watch a bad movie and then talk about it afterwards. So, yeah.
You might have to review the 2006 version of Sisters. Maybe that could be your bad movie night.
I'll put that on the list. Yeah.
Oh. If you do talk about that, if I can send like a voice clip about my thoughts on that movie, please let me know if I can. I would love to be involved in that show in any way possible. But yes, don't forget to check out more of Majesty at the Movies on their site, majestymovies.com. Follow them on Twitter at majestymovies. Do you gentlemen have Instagram? I think you do.
We do not. So we have Twitter, which is Majesty. So I'm trying to do a succinct branding across all platforms. Okay. So we're on Twitter as Majesty Movies. Facebook as Majesty Movies, and then our website, MajestyMovies.com.
Gotcha, yes. Follow them on there. I believe you can find them on most all of your favorite podcast platforms. Definitely check them out. And I hope you enjoyed this episode of Cinema Recall. We're going to take a small little hiatus break for Cinema Recall. Basically, for all of our listeners, I'm going to be posting a lot of our bonus episodes that were on our Patreon page and then put them as their main shows. There's going to be some episodes, but nothing new right now, just because I'm starting to do more editing work for Forza Crowd Podcast, and that takes up a lot of my times. Plus, I'm going to be getting another, possibly like full-time job as well, and that's going to take up a lot of my time, and so I'm going to need some time break there. But check out all of our older episodes. We're available. Most of them are on cinemarecall.net. We're available on Stitcher, Spotify, Podchaser, most places to find podcasts on. Our Twitter is at @cinema_recall. And then Facebook, Instagram is just Cinema Recall Podcast. Big shout out to our Patreon subscribers. Thank you very much for being a Patreon member. You get a shout out in every episode, $5 a month. So gotta give a shout out here in no special order. Gotta thank, first of all, Matt and Ashley from Ashley and the Movies, thank you very much for being a Patreon member. I really greatly appreciate the support. Gotta thank Jason Soto of Whatever with Jason Soto. Thank you very much, Jason. Gotta thank Jeanette Miller-Mickenham. Find her on Twitter at @HAJeanette. And also gotta thank Donnie Roberts of Cage's Kiss Podcast. I've been trying to contact Donnie Roberts because he signed up for a $10 tier, and he has a chance to host an episode. So right now, he has like 3 episodes that he has to host, and he hasn't hosted them yet. So maybe we'll do like a whole long episode with Donnie Roberts. I'm not quite sure. But anyways, folks, hope you had a great time. I enjoyed doing Diploma December very much. I'm not quite sure who our next director is going to be. It may be, I'm thinking Terrence Malick. Do a Malick May happening. I'm not really quite sure. We may think of that later. I kind of want to do a Sofia Coppola September, but I'll think about these shows later on. But I hope you enjoyed your time on here. I love you all, and I hope you all have a very happy new year, and we'll see each other very soon.
Bye-bye.